This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there, and a very pleasant day to you. This is Joel Hilliker. It is graduation time in many countries this time of year. But this year, many students' education has been negatively impacted by coronavirus. Teachers and students have been trying to make things work through video conferencing and other technologies. The quality of education has suffered. Many graduation ceremonies have been canceled. In our final segment and our last word on today's program, I'm going to play for you a commencement address that I recently gave at the graduation of Imperial Academy. This is the K through 12 school here at the offices of Trumpet Radio in Edmond, Oklahoma. And this is about how important it is for students to have a fire and a passion for education and for truth, and all the more so in these unprecedented times of trial and test. Before that, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic about the coronavirus itself. The question of where this virus came from is receiving a lot of scrutiny, with evidence mounting that it was specifically engineered in a Chinese lab. But we'll hear a report explaining how it may have even been the product of a deliberate plan by China to launch a pandemic. But to start the program today, we'll talk about an interesting development regarding the state of Israel, as it has suffered from a rain of rockets from Hamas. It's actually enjoying some understanding and sympathy from some unlikely sources, including neighboring Arab states. Now, if you look at this through the lens of biblical prophecy, this support might not be what it appears to be. We'll learn about this in this report from Richard Palmer.
Israel's conflict with Hamas has exposed some critical changes in the state's relationships around the world. The most important regard the United States, this conflict exposes just how radically the Biden administration is from the previous one. In just a matter of months, Israel's relationship with its most critical ally has crumbled. Our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall, has written and talked extensively about the major changes in this relationship and what they mean. But another set of relationships have shifted, seemingly to Israel's benefit. Wasim Youssef tweeted to his 1.6 million followers that you have made Gaza a graveyard for the innocent and children. Now, a popular Muslim preacher in the United Arab Emirates condemning Israel would not be news, but Youssef was actually blaming Hamas for these deaths. Hamas launches rockets from within civilian neighborhoods, and when the response comes, Hamas cries, "Where are the Arabs and Muslims? You have made Gaza a graveyard for the innocent and the children," reads the full tweet. Now remember, the UAE is not America, a land with free speech and free religion. Its government is allowing Youssef to post this. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has condemned Hamas's missile attacks on Israeli civilians. Geopolitical Futures founder George Friedman noted that both events are indicative of a significant shift in Arab sentiment toward events in Gaza. Across the Middle East, Arab messages of support for the Palestinians and condemnation towards Israel have been much more tepid this time than usual. But that's not the only significant shift. On May 16th, Die Welt had a headline, "The next attack on Israel's existence comes from the USA." Israel has always been able to rely on Washington, the article notes, but the current conflict shows how far the Democratic Party has slipped to the left. Demands by some congressmen are shaking the foundations of the Jewish state. But instead, Israel's been receiving more supportive statements from Germany. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said, "We stand for Israel's right to self-defense, and that's why it is right that Israel is taking massive action." German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas traveled to Israel last week. He also supported Israel's right to defend itself against, quote, "massive and unacceptable attacks," and he promised that Germany's support is not limited to words. Israeli Foreign Minister Gabi Ashkenazi said the fact that the German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas is now visiting Israel while sirens are echoing is the clearest sign of solidarity and Israeli-German friendship possible, and said that he was grateful for Germany's support since the beginning of the war. On May 20th, politicians from all across almost all of Germany's political parties gathered together at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin to express their support for Israel. Die Welt wrote that the commitment of the federal ministers, parliamentary group leaders of all parties represented in the Bundestag, with the exception of the AfD, and other top people was unanimous. We stand firmly on Israel's side. German Vice Chancellor and leader of the Social Democratic Party, Olaf Scholz, said the security of the Jewish state is a German raison d'etre. Whoever attacks Israel and Jews in Germany is attacking us. But Germany isn't Israel's only European friend. Austria flew the Israeli flag over its chancellery building in Vienna on May 14th, prompting a diplomatic tiff with Turkey and prompting Iran's foreign minister to cancel a previously scheduled visit. France increasingly sees Israel as an ally in its fight against radical Islam. A French parliamentary spokesman for the ruling La République En Marche party said, "We have a common front with Israel, the struggle against Islamist terrorism. More than ever, it's what brings us closer and what explains the diplomatic shift in Europe." Foreign Policy noted that the continent has seen a progressive, undeniable shift in its relationship with Israel. It wrote that the most recent fighting with Palestinians has revealed a radical change in European foreign policy that's been years in the making. It pointed out that since the Abraham Accords, supporting Israel has become much less expensive. You know, it used to mean alienating the Arabs. Now it doesn't. Now, none of this, I think, is going to make Angela Merkel the next Donald Trump. There's not going to be a Merkelville built next to Trump Heights. They're not as supportive as America was under President Trump. But with America swinging to the radical left, suddenly Germany looks like a relatively appealing partner. You know, maybe lukewarm support from Europe is better than an America that blows hot and cold. Throw in President Emmanuel Macron's increasingly anti-Islamist France, President Sebastian Kurz's Austria, and Europe starts to look like a pretty good bet for Israel. So you've had the Abraham Accords eroding the Arab world's opposition to Israel, while the rise of the radical left in America seems to have made Europe the relatively better partner. But looks can be deceiving. At the start of this year, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry warned that these recent peace pacts have a deadly flaw. He continued, "Bible prophecy gives us deep insight into these agreements. It actually foretells that moderate Arabs will unite, somewhat like what we are seeing now. But they are prophesied not to cooperate with the United States or Israel. A prophecy in Psalm 83 exposes a hidden reality behind these peace deals. We are already in the beginning stages of its fulfillment." So Psalm 83 forecasts an alliance of nations that will come together against Israel. It's an alliance that Israel has never faced in history. It's a prophetic forecast. The Bible emphasizes that this alliance plots in secret. Psalm 83 in verse 3 in the New International Version states, "With cunning they conspire against your people. They plot against those you cherish." This alliance includes the Ishmaelites, the Arabic descendants of Ishmael, noted in verse 6, and it also includes Asher or Assyria, modern-day Germany, which is noted in verse 8. So these nations that look like potential allies today are exactly the same nations that are prophesied to plot against and betray Israel. Other scriptures show that this betrayal revolves around a peace deal, and already many of the parties involved are stepping forwards to broker peace. Germany's foreign minister visited Israel for exactly that purpose and pledged 40 million euros for humanitarian assistance in Gaza. The United Arab Emirates Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed said over the weekend that his nation would be willing to mediate between the two sides. Mr. Flurry wrote in that January article, "While it seems that these nations are moving away from radicalism and violence, we must look beneath the surface. After all, this prophecy reveals they will take crafty counsel, subtle and shrewd dealing. This prophecy shows that these nations will try to blot out the name of Israel forever. That is intense hatred." And a look beneath the surface quickly reveals that intense hatred. Wasim Yosef, the Israel-supporting cleric in the United Arab Emirates, has suffered for his stance. His government may be happy to let him post, but in Jordan, several members of parliament have called for his Jordanian citizenship to be revoked. Over the weekend, unsubstantiated reports of Yosef being beaten up and his car burned have been circulating on social media. At this point, it's unclear if the attack was real or if his many opponents are fantasizing, but neither option is great. In Germany, the widespread political support for Israel came in response to a shocking outbreak of anti-Semitism, with synagogues being attacked, Israeli flags burned in the streets, and an Israeli journalist attacked at a pro-Palestinian rally. And this isn't a problem just with Germany's Muslim districts. A study of 2,500 Germans by Leipzig University conducted last year found that 68% mostly or partially agreed with the statement, Israel's policies in Palestine are just as bad as the policies of the Nazis in World War II. That doesn't sound like the foundation of a good, lasting relationship. And this kind of anti-Semitic sentiment has found its way into official policies. An investigation by Israel's Shin Bet found that millions of dollars flowed from the European Union to the terrorist group, the Population Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The EU hands a lot of money over to non-governmental organizations, and it has done very little to look into where this money goes later. At best, they have been disturbingly complacent about their money ending up in the hands of terrorists. One German newspaper noted that the EU itself classifies the PFLP as a terrorist group, and they wrote, yet many European governments ignore the findings about the money going to this group and continue to invest heavily in these NGOs, leading to misuse of taxpayers' money. I think even the fact that they're most disturbed that this is a misuse of taxpayers' money rather than terrorists are being funded is also a little disturbing. But Germany's Green Party, they were among those that gathered in Berlin at the Brandenburg Gate to express their support to Israel. But Friday for Future, a youth movement with strong links to the Green Party, has openly sided with Hamas. They tweeted that non-violence is not an appropriate option for the Palestinians. In his article, Mr. Flurry warned Germany and its European allies will enter the glorious land, Jerusalem, not by force, but under the guise of peace. The indication here is that Israel will actually invite the Germans in because they believe they already have peace with them. The current peace deal between Israel and the Arab states are creating this sense of security, but Israel should be more aware of history and prophecy. What awaits the Jews at the hand of this European-Arab alliance is one of the most treacherous betrayals in history. And you take a look beneath the surface, you can see that building already. On the surface, the response by Germany and these Arab states to this Gaza conflict is just increasing that sense of security that Mr. Flurry talked about, but it is a mirage. Israel will try just about anything to bring peace, except look to God. But they're not alone in this. All around the world, we have many different problems, but no nation is turning to God to solve them. Events in the Middle East are rapidly proving that man cannot solve his problems without God. It's a lesson the whole world is going to have to learn. Jerusalem contains a message that God will soon give the whole world. To learn more about that message and about the events that we see in this region right now, please do read our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
Thank you very much for that, Richard. It is a fascinating story. You mentioned that a lot of this apparent support for Israel is coming as a result of the loss in support from the United States with the change from Donald Trump to Joe Biden. Israel's looking for new allies here. But we've talked a lot about on Trumpet Hour about how the Biden administration is so pro-Iran. And many of these nations see the real threat in the region is Iran, and all the more so with Joe Biden in power. How much of what we're seeing is these other nations recognizing that if they don't push back against Hamas, they're actually empowering Iran?
Yes, I certainly think fear of Iran is a major factor behind all of this. And I mentioned France, for example, making common cause with Israel because of a common approach to radical Islam. And then fear of Iran was pretty much the whole rationale behind the Abraham Accords. This was why Saudi Arabia, why some of the United Arab Emirates signed a peace deal with Israel. They wanted to be able to, they wanted to have an ally when it comes to a conflict with Iran. And I think that's why the Abraham Accords have stuck. They want to a certain extent, they want to continue to make sure that they have that. They have their eye on Iran as being the bigger threat to them. Regarding Iran, whether Iran's influence with Hamas has kind of reached the point now that other Arab states have given up trying to compete with Iran for influence with Hamas and are just trying to side with Israel against Hamas? I don't know. I don't know whether we've reached that point. Turkey certainly hasn't. I think they are still making a strong bid to, or I mean, their relationship with Hamas is kind of complicated, but I think in the recent outbreak of conflict, they have tried to use this to maybe gain some influence with Hamas and some of those other powers. But I'm sure concern over Iran's links with Hamas have played a role into a lot of this.
Now, you're looking at this Psalm 83 prophecy and the alignment between Germany, European states, and these Arab states. The other side of this is the prophecy regarding this conflict between Europe and Iran. And this is something that we watch very closely to see this how events are leading toward this confrontation. The way that this is playing out, we see Israel relying on Germany for increasingly as an ally, but we also see, and that also is prophesied, but we also see Germany being very careful in trying to put a hedge around Iran's influence in the region, and you could definitely see what's happening here in that context.
Yes, and again, especially with France, I think they've been the ones that have been most vocal about confronting radical Islam. But yes, Germany certainly does have some military relationships with Israel, most notably with manufacturing their submarines and that kind of thing, and deepening relationships with Saudi Arabia and some of these other countries.
Well, there's a whole lot to keep our eyes on in light of all that this is taking place between Hamas and Israel, and the support that Iran has provided for Hamas, and now what these other countries are doing, actually the divisions that you see taking place within the Palestinian or within the Arab world. And you look at several prophecies that we have kept our eyes on for years that are really right in the forefront of everything that's taking place here. It's really interesting to watch. We will keep our eyes on it. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about specifically the Arab and European support for Israel. He's written an article, Gaza Conflict Reveals a Changed World. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The official story of how the COVID-19 pandemic started was that it naturally jumped from an animal at the wet market in Wuhan, China, to a shopper there, and from there it spread to all around the world. As the pandemic continues to ravage world order, more and more evidence is piling up that the virus origins actually lie in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, a laboratory known to collaborate with the Chinese military on biological weapons and located 7 miles from the market. Some new evidence surfaced this month when Sky News Australia reported on May 9th of a People's Liberation Army handbook that contains material on bioweapons startlingly reminiscent to what the COVID-19 pandemic has done to the world. The book is called The Unnatural Origin of SARS and New Species of Man-Made Viruses as Genetic Weapons, and it was first published in 2015. No English translation apparently exists yet, but it can still be found online in Mandarin, and select passages have been translated into English by Western media. Some of the passages have eerie parallels with today. Here is one such passage. Large-scale biological weapon attacks can cause many indirect consequences in addition to human casualties. Major impacts include enormous burden on healthcare systems. The book even states that the bioweapon crisis, quote, could cause the enemy's medical system to collapse. Think about the government's warnings of our hospitals being overwhelmed. Think about how some countries base their lockdowns on the stress on their healthcare systems. Think about how millions are pressuring their governments for access to untested vaccines. Here's an example of this. In the United Kingdom, where this segment is being recorded, a slogan one often hears from the government is, "Save lives, protect the NHS," referring to the National Health Services. Much of the British government's COVID-19 plan revolves around stopping the NHS from collapsing. Many of the coronavirus restrictions people have and had to face, which businesses were allowed to be open and which ones had to close, which foreign countries you were allowed to visit, was based on how much of a risk, or a perceived risk, there was on the healthcare system, just as the book described. Here is another passage, quote, "Biological weapons will not only cause widespread morbidity and mass casualties, but also induce formidable psychological pressure that could affect combat readiness. Just like other disasters, people will live under fear of an attack for a considerable period of time after an attack, causing brief or lasting psychological impairment among some." In other words, attacks using biological weapons can cause acute and chronic psychological and mental illnesses, such as acute stress reactions, unquote. In the Western world especially, much of the response to COVID-19 has been motivated by fear. Fear is what motivates the enactments of policies like mandatory face masks. Fear is what's motivating people to not go to work and stay cooped up in their houses for months. Fear is what motivates some to keep their masks on even after they've been vaccinated. Fear is what encourages people to spy on their neighbors and report to the authorities when someone does something as innocuous as inviting guests over to their houses. What may be most chilling about this book is its rationale for using bioweapons. Conventional attacks can be traced to their origins, triggering international backlash. But bioweapons, according to the handbook, can be concealed in deployment, and it is hard finding evidence against them. The book continues, "Even in the face of academic, virological, or animal evidence, one can deny, prevent someone from raising the issue, suppress possible accusations, leaving international organizations and righteous people helpless." As aforementioned, there are many indications that the COVID-19 virus came from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The institute has collaborated with the Chinese military in the past. There are also indications that the COVID-19 virus was genetically tampered with. Whether it is an intentional bioweapon or a science experiment gone wrong is unclear at this point. But think about how China has been trying so hard to disassociate itself from the virus. With the original wet market theory since debunked, Beijing has tried to blame other countries for the virus. The Chinese government claimed that the virus is an American bioweapon introduced by American soldiers visiting Wuhan. Another story is that it's stowed away on frozen food imports from places like Brazil. There is no credible support for either theory. Even if China is not at fault for intentionally starting the pandemic, its response at once the pandemic started implicates it in biowarfare. When it was clear that COVID-19 was to be a very serious threat, Beijing put Wuhan into a lockdown. People couldn't travel into and out of the city, that is, to and from other parts of China. But international travel from Wuhan was allowed. The Chinese government even lobbied other countries to accept flights from Wuhan, despite the situation with the virus there. This demonstrates that China knew what it was doing. This would, conventionally, be enough to consider China guilty of using biological weapons. Yet China has still been able to make itself look innocent, not only in the eyes of the international community in general, but in many of the health experts that these members of the international community rely on for policy. And not only that, but with its international vaccination program, exporting vaccines like Sinopharm, China actually looks like the hero to many countries. Again, just as the book described. The book has several authors. One of its two editors-in-chief was Zhu Dejong. He was the head of the team sent to investigate a SARS epidemic in China roughly two decades ago. SARS is another coronavirus disease and a close relative of COVID-19. Zhu is a professor and doctoral supervisor at China's Air Force Medical University's Military Epidemiology Department. He has trained over 100 students, including those applying for their doctorates. An analyst at the research organization Drastic said that Zhu is training up the latest generation of People's Liberation Army scientists. He is well respected both in his field and in the Chinese Communist Party. In other words, the latest generation of biological experts in the Chinese military were educated for years by an influential Communist Party member who is an expert in coronavirus epidemics and how to use bioweapons. And the information in his bioweapons handbook matches what has happened with the COVID-19 pandemic almost to the letter. At the very least, the unnatural origin of SARS and new species of man-made viruses as genetic weapons is more proof that China is an extremely dangerous country that poses a threat to world order and stability. The true extent, however, of the threat that China poses to the world, and America especially, isn't realized by many. The COVID-19 pandemic is only the tip of the iceberg. If you would like to learn more fully about China's subtle infiltration warfare, please read the cover article for our February 2021 Trumpet print issue, Wake Up to the Threat from China. You can find an online version of it at thetrumpet.com.
Thank you very much, Mihailo. So you talk about this book from 2015 about the possibility of China launching a pandemic. Can you just talk about the evidence that COVID-19 was specifically engineered in a Chinese lab?
Of course. There is unfortunately no smoking gun as of this point that has been found to incriminate the Chinese government. But there is a lot of interesting circumstantial evidence that at least raises my eyebrows and raises a lot of other people's as well. Like, for example, the original theory that it came from the Wuhan wet market and analysis at that market. Originally, they thought it came from bats. Apparently, there's a lot of different animals that are sold in this wet market. And then they all of a sudden changed the story to that it came from pangolins, or also known as a scaly anteater. But analysis from the virus suggests that it wasn't any of those animals, and a testing at the market itself showed that none of the animals tested positive for coronavirus in the area. So it obviously didn't come from the wet market, and then the government came in and did an aggressive cleaning of the market that some analysts compare to disturbing a crime scene. So there's that, which is admittedly circumstantial, but there's a lot more than just that. For example, patient zero has been traced to a person that didn't visit the wet market and of all places works at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And ever since that came out, this person, Huan Yang Lin, ended up going missing. The person apparently, like all of her records on the Virology Institute's website have been removed from her. They won't answer any questions, which is certainly pretty suspect. And not only that, but with bat coronaviruses, there was a study. The Wuhan Institute of Virology is considered a specialist in the field of bat coronaviruses. It's the only biosafety level 4 institute that China has. That's the biosafety level required to and be internationally certified to keep deadly diseases of the likes of Ebola or anthrax. And it's a specialist in bat coronaviruses. And in 2019, it was investigating a coronavirus epidemic in this bat cave where people caught some sort of illness that has symptoms remarkably similar to what COVID-19 provides. And ever since the pandemic has been going around, that cave where they analyzed the bats has been closed off to international observers. The press aren't allowed to go in there. Western media has been trying to get in there. It's been closed off. So at the very least, it suggests that the Chinese government is hiding something and that it's implicated a lot more than what it admits to and to what many international observers claim about it as well.
It's interesting how much China has actually benefited from this virus being as widespread as it is. When you look back at some of the data in that 2015 book, we have another article in addition to the one that you have written that talks about China's mask diplomacy. Can you just tell us about how it's actually exploited this to its advantage just within Asia?
Oh, of course. When the pandemic first came out, everybody—well, I shouldn't say everybody—but a lot of people thought this was it for the Chinese economy. That no one was going to want to do business with them. That their rise in economic prominence of the world was going to plummet. And surprisingly, to a lot of people, the exact opposite has happened. While many of the Western governments' economies have shrunk, trying to deal with the effects of lockdown and other things like that, China has actually grown. And part of the reason it's grown was because of its ability to distribute things like face masks, exports, vaccines, other things like that to countries that are struggling, especially, and this is especially concerning with Asia, considering China is the major economy in the area. All smaller countries in Southeast Asia and other places naturally gravitate to them to get their medical supplies. For example, Laos just received its fourth shipment of vaccines and other medical supplies from China. The deputy prime minister of the country, Kikeo Kaihamtithuine, I'm probably saying that wrong, but he said that the help from China reflects the profound friendship, those are his words, between the two countries and other countries as well, like, for example, Cambodia. On February, Cambodia received 600,000 doses of Chinese vaccines. The Cambodian health minister, Mam Bung Heng, said that, quote, "This assistance is a new testament to the unbreakable friendship, solidarity, and cooperation between Cambodia and China," unquote. So you have all these other countries, and other countries, like Vietnam, Thailand, Myanmar, the Philippines. China is making inroads into these countries, and a lot of them normally are pretty wary of China. Like, for example, the Philippines, China's been putting territorial claims on Philippine islands, like the Spratlys and the Paracels. But the Philippines, under Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte, has been looking to China to help its recover from the pandemic and to get its medical supplies. So you see even countries that are traditionally not on the best terms with China being forced, or I shouldn't even say being forced, just naturally gravitating to the Chinese juggernaut economy to get itself back into power. And this shows China really cementing its footprint in Asia in an era when it's competing with the U.S. and India and other countries to with influence in that region. And as countries like India, as of now, are currently really hurt badly with the virus and their economy hurt as well, China's been able to outfox them in this case.
Well, as you say, no smoking gun, but you look at the effects of everything that has taken place here, and whether or not it was intentional, the effects really do show that China is benefiting in pretty much exactly the way that they talked about in that book that you discussed in your report. We've been talking with trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic about a book written in China back in 2015 about the possibility of waging a war through a pandemic. He's written an article, "Did China Prepare Years Ago to Launch a Pandemic?" You can find that at thetrumpet.com. And also that article, "China's Mask Diplomacy," that he was just talking about. We appreciate you being on the show so much. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
It's time for today's Last Word.
Graduations are happening all over this time of year. I had the honor of participating in one of them, as I'd like to show you in a few minutes. But first, let's talk about the class of 2021 in general, the class of COVID. This has been an unprecedented year for all of us, but especially for those for whom it was their senior year, as they were preparing to launch into adulthood. Their governments banned them from school. Classes were canceled. Extracurricular activities were canceled. Graduation itself, in many cases, was canceled. Students in all grades basically missed an entire year of attending school in many cases. What effects have these bans had on our students and their future? In America, we're looking at a country where already you had a case study of problematic education. American students are notoriously well-funded and notoriously underperforming. We spend an estimated $16,000 per year on every single student in this country. That's 60% more than the average nation. But rather than leading the world by 60% in basic academic understanding, we lag well behind other nations. One study found American students are 38th out of 71 in math and 24th in science. Why is this? Well, part of that is the fact that schools have been devoting more and more of their time to weaker, irrelevant, and downright wrong studies like gender issues, critical race theory that's becoming popular these days, histories of perceived racism, and so on. Part of it is the fact that our schools are filled with so much garbage besides studying. Lots of distractions, disrespect for teachers, cheating, emotion, romance, pregnancy, drugs, and really an overall lack of fire for learning. It's kind of an open secret that American education is filled with so much besides actual education in language and history and math, science, art, sports, and morality. And then came the year of COVID. Whatever spark for learning a student had, now he had to survive a confusing array of government guidelines, school shutdowns, little to no face-to-face interactions, endless fiddling with computer connections, spending day after day in their living room or kitchen or wherever, trying to learn in front of a computer, if they showed up at all. Just imagine being an 18-year-old or maybe a 12-year-old and spending an entire academic year in this situation. What do you think the effect would be on you? And what would be the effect when you multiply that problem by millions upon millions of students? Axios reported yesterday that the GDP loss in America alone from losing a year of education is estimated to be in the multiple trillions of dollars. It reported the findings of 7 nonprofits that found public benefits of school closures are questionable. It said any benefits to closing schools are far outweighed by the grave risks to children from remote-only schooling, risks that intensify the longer it continues. The harm includes academic loss, so severe that it could set children back for life, and mental health problems related to loneliness and isolation. I'm still reading this Axios report. There are also severe hardships on parents, mothers in particular, about 2 million of whom have left the workforce to care for their kids as part of remote learning. It also said that academics are basically falling off a cliff. A result that is, quote, expected to have deep social and economic repercussions for years, if not decades, to come. These students are feared to be, quote, missing key academic milestones, falling behind grade level, and in some cases, dropping out of the educational system altogether. They're also missing out on a crucial social development that comes only from interactions with peers. The economic impact could be staggering. McKinsey estimates that the average K through 12 student in the U.S. could lose $61,000 to $82,000 in lifetime earnings, or the equivalent of a year of full-time work, as a result of learning losses related to COVID-19. The World Bank estimates that close to 7 million students worldwide could drop out of school due to the income shock of the pandemic alone. Globally, a school shutdown of 5 months could cause learning losses amounting to $10 trillion. Now, whether you graduated this year or quite a few years ago, you probably grew up hearing that education is important. But even the people saying that don't realize just how true it is. Education is about books and tests and so on. Yes, of course it is, but it's about so much more than that. Education is everything your parents, your teachers, the older generation has given you that has shaped not only your grade point average, but shaped who you are. Education really is central to our lives. I'm happy to say there's a place where true education is taking place, pursuing the right purpose and free from the garbage filling up so many schools. And it's not because the students or the administrators are naturally amazing. It's because it's a school built on the right foundation. Trumpet Hour, as many of you know, is produced by the Philadelphia Church of God. And this church also sponsors a number of other initiatives. One of them is a school for the children of the church members here at our headquarters and an online school for children around the world. It's called Imperial Academy. At this year's graduation 2 weeks ago, I spoke to the students about the importance of their education and building a fire for learning and for truth. This is the commencement address from Imperial Academy's graduation ceremony 2021.
Imperial Academy administration and faculty, distinguished guests, friends, and loving families, students, and most of all, Imperial Academy graduating class of 2021. To be able to speak to you this evening is what I would call an unexpected honor. I never would have expected to be principal of a school, to be able to hand out diplomas to a group of graduating seniors, but life takes unexpected turns sometimes. And now I have the task of postponing handing out those diplomas for about 15 more minutes to share one last bit of wisdom as you journey forth into the rest of your lives. So if you just sit tight for a little longer. Normally in these circumstances, I would try to imagine what I would say to my own children if I were speaking to them. It so happens I have the unexpected opportunity to hand one of those diplomas to my own daughter, so I don't have to imagine. I'll just talk to you while I'm talking with her. Sometimes the unexpected turns that life takes are wonderful blessings. God gives us special, meaningful experiences, moments that really make your heart sing. I think a lot of parents in the room tonight can identify with that feeling. But those unexpected turns aren't always so joyful. Sometimes they can be pretty tough. This whole world has been going through some astonishing unexpected turns this past year. People losing jobs, concerning political developments. In a lot of ways, this world is a completely different place than anybody would have predicted a year or two ago. But even then, some of those tough turns end up shifting in unexpected directions. Recently, a doctor told my mom that she has a heart condition that will get worse and worse until she dies from it. And we didn't know if she would make it 3 months. Well, that was 9 months ago. Her heart has actually gotten better. It's this past Sunday we were able to celebrate Mother's Day with her. Her heart still isn't completely right, but it's definitely singing because she knows and she can see God behind that whole experience. And I try to record these kinds of blessings and miracles in my journal. I really recommend that you do that. It helps because there are times when things don't seem so miraculous. They look pretty dark, in fact, and it's always good to look back and remember those times when the storm clouds were gathering, and then the light broke through, and God worked things out in a beautiful way, and he showed that he was there all along. Those kinds of experiences humble you. They help you to know that God is looking after you, even the details in your life. And if you cherish those moments, they really do help you to trust God, to trust your Father. This has everything to do with the education that you've gotten at Imperial Academy. The Irish poet William Butler Yeats said, "Education is not the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire." And that's a terrific description, not only of the excitement of true education, the glow and the radiance of true education, but also the challenge. Filling a pail is fairly straightforward. Lighting a fire can actually be pretty difficult. At Imperial Academy, we really do want to light a fire in you students, a fire for education, a fire for knowledge, a fire for truth, a fire that urges you forward, that drives you to seek great things, that inspires you to work your tail off, to fulfill your potential, to fulfill your incredible imperial destiny. That kind of fire isn't easy to build. A few summers ago at a youth camp at our Edstone campus, I taught a little class in outdoorsmanship, including how to build a fire. And we covered the fact that a fire needs three elements. It needs fuel, it needs oxygen, and it needs heat. But it needs the right kind of fuel. You have to gather your tinder and your kindling and your fuel wood, and you have to use them in the right amount at the right time, or you'll smother that fire. It needs the right amount of oxygen. You have to build a structure that has enough air getting to that fire, but you also have to protect it from getting too much wind that would blow it out. In England, we also had to ward off the summer rain from those English skies, which would extinguish that flame. We had all the right elements, and still sometimes it was difficult getting those fires lit. Those fires are vulnerable in the early stages. They're easy to put out. But the stronger a fire gets, the more resistant to the elements it is, the more you can feed it with bigger and more substantial fuel. And in the end, if you've done it right, like we did at that summer camp, it reaches the point that you can bake your biscuit in it. And it's a good analogy. At IA, we really do try to give you good fuel and oxygen and heat, and it's not easy. I'm sure sometimes we probably try to throw a log on you when maybe you're more at the kindling stage, or we might try to blow on you and ignite a spark and exhale a little too hard. Maybe we get a little spittle in your face. But we are trying to work to create the best possible environment for creating a good flame, getting a fire lit in you. The world around us has never had so many factors that would smother or extinguish those fires in the lives of young people. And God has given us a lot of protection from so many of those elements. But even in the best conditions, it still takes a lot of work to light that fire. So now you're moving on in life, and it's so important that that fire be strong. It's so important that it be strong enough that you're ready for more of the gusts, more of the rains that you'll face as you move forward into adulthood. How strong is that fire in your life? I hope and pray that you really have a healthy blaze going, that you'll keep feeding that so that it's strong enough to keep going. A young person with fire and a friendship with God is on the path to greatness, no matter what unexpected turns life takes. Think for a moment about a teenager named David. He had a job that most people would consider pretty lowly. He was watching sheep, but he poured his whole heart into that job. He was so protective of those sheep that when a bear and a lion attacked them, he threw his strength and sinew into battling them with his bare hands. David was a young man of action, and he worked his tail off. He obviously used his time in that humdrum job to master the slingshot, and he prodded himself to learn how to play harp at a royal level. He wrote poetry. He worked and trained to express himself in artful ways. He pondered the big questions in life. He contemplated the cosmos. And he built a remarkable friendship with the architect of the universe. And God loved the fire in that young man. He loved his heart. He loved that boy's heart. And you look at what God did in his life. He established a royal throne in that man that's going to last forever. And God can take any young person who works like that and who thinks like that. He can take any young person like that on a thrilling adventure, and that's what he wants to do with you. He wants to challenge you, maybe throw an occasional bear or lion at you, and give you opportunities that stretch you and transform you into a bigger, bolder, stronger person and help you to fulfill your potential. That's what God wants to do with you. When you go outside on a clear night and you look up like young David did, you can not only see the moon, which is 238,000 miles away, but just with your naked eye, you can see somewhere between 3,000 and 10,000 stars. Suns that are so far distant that the light that is reaching your eye left its source thousands of years ago. Now, what does that tell you about God? That he created the world to make sure that you would have that view when you looked up at the sky. You are literally looking eons and eons into the past. And beyond that, you're also looking at a future that stretches into eternity, an imperial destiny. When God actually uses his family to populate and beautify those distant worlds. That's what you see. In fact, God positioned our planet in such a way that with modern telescopes, we can peer out into innumerable galaxies that David couldn't even dream of. He never imagined what we're able to see. God really does want us to dream big. Don't get caught staring at your feet or gazing at your navel. Don't get distracted by the silly things in this noisy world. Keep your eyes on the horizon. Keep looking up and keep drawing closer to the God who created all that. The same God, the same awesome God who's also taking care of even the smallest details in your life. When you put your life in his hands, you never know exactly what path he's going to take you on. But you can be sure that ultimately it's going to lead to somewhere beautiful and somewhere filled with light. Think about a teenager named Joseph. Joseph had dreams. He dreamed that the lights in the heavens, the sun, the moon, and the stars bowed down to him. He had a vision of being great. He had a vision of being a leader among men. And that seemed impossible for the youngest child in a large family growing up in the desert. But, you know, through those dreams, God was actually giving him a glimpse of his future. And Joseph didn't ignore those visions. He didn't walk away from what he saw, and he didn't let other people discourage him. There were plenty of people who were jealous and uneasy because he was so driven. People hated him for those dreams. And Joseph didn't mind that. He never let that stamp out his fire. Joseph believed in those dreams. And even when life took some really frustrating, unexpected turns, he cherished those dreams. He was made a slave, given the lowliest, most degrading jobs you can imagine. And what did he do? He made himself indispensable. That fire in him inspired him to keep prodding himself through all that grueling work. Those dreams fortified him to resist and forsake temptation. They gave him determination and patience and grit. Joseph stayed close to God, and he worked his tail off. And God was able to exalt him to the second most powerful man in a mighty world empire. All those impossible dreams became reality. And graduates, you have an even greater future than that young man had. The path to that future is different for every one of us. Sometimes God will let you get thrown into a pit, only to bring you out and then plunge you into an even worse trial. God will allow circumstances that seem opposite the direction that you want your life to go. But keep that fire burning. Never stop believing in those dreams. Never let go of the vision that God has given you of your future. Wise King Solomon wrote, "The path of the just is as the shining light that shines more and more unto the perfect day." Graduates, that's your path. That's the path that God has you on. Stay with him, and you can guarantee that your future is as bright as a cloudless sunrise, that it's as luminous as a night sky brimming with stars. Dream big. Throw yourself into your life with all your might. Every day, keep stoking that fire that God has lit in you. And let that urge you forward and drive you to seek great things. Never let the distractions and the cares of this tired old world snuff out that fire. Don't take a single day for granted, because life takes unexpected turns at times. Ever since that doctor told my mom about her heart condition, her motto has been, "Make hay while the sun shines." And she's been treating every day like the gift that it is. With gratitude, with humility, she keeps on smiling and making the most of the moment and keeping her eyes on the horizon and putting her life where it belongs, in God's hands. If you can learn to do that now, while you're holding this diploma that we're about to give you, your life is going to be far brighter. It's going to be filled with far more miracles. Your path is going to shine more and more as you make your way toward your future and that perfect day. You'll have a lot more heart-singing moments and experiences to remember and cherish, because you know God is working out even the details, the smallest details in your life. Stay close to him and work your tail off. Keep your eyes on the horizon and trust your Father. Trust him to forge your path, whatever unexpected turns it takes. Trust him to transform you into a bigger, bolder, stronger person and to help you fulfill your potential, your incredible imperial destiny.
Thank you.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer and Mihailo Zekic. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Albert Einstein. Logic will get you from A to B. Imagination will take you everywhere. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.